Thanks, guys. Tim, alcoholic.
So we're going to get a chance to learn a little something about the pioneers, and we're going to be looking at the pioneer stories, which there are 10 of them, and I'd love if everybody would just turn to page 165. Personal stories. How 42 alcoholics recovered from their malady. Beginning with the story of Dr. Bob, a co-founder of AA, there are here presented three groups of personal histories. Part one, and the part that we're going to be dealing with over the next 10 weeks, Pioneers of AA. This group of 10 stories shows that sobriety in AA can be lasting. Part two, they stopped in time. 17 stories may help you decide whether you are an alcoholic, also whether AA is for you. Part three, they lost nearly all. Those who believe their drinking to be hopeless may again find hope in these 15 impressive tales. And we'll go to the next page. Part one, Pioneers of AA. Dr. Bob and the 9 men and women who here tell their stories were among the early members of AA's first groups. All 10 have now passed away of natural causes, having maintained complete sobriety. Today, hundreds of additional AA members can be found who have had no relapse for more than 50 years. All of these, then, are the pioneers of AA. They bear witness that release from alcoholism can really be permanent. All right, let's get started. Dr. Bob's Nightmare used to be titled The Doctor's Nightmare. In the second edition, it was changed to this title. A co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, the birth of our society dates from his first day of permanent sobriety. June 10th, 1935, to 1950, the year of his death, he carried the AA message to more than 5,000 alcoholic men and women, and to all these he gave his medical services without thought of charge. In this prodigy of service, he was well assisted by Sister Ignatia at St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, Ohio. One of the greatest friends our fellowship will ever know. So Dr. Bob was born on August 8th in 1879, and as it does state, he did die in 1950. Specifically, he died on 11-16-50. I was born in a small New England village of about 7,000 souls. So the small New England village he's referring to is St. Johnsbury, Vermont. It's approximately 100 miles away from Manchester, Vermont, which is where Bill Wilson was born. So there's a strong connection to Vermont for us as AA members. The general moral standard was, as I recall it, far above the average. No beer or liquor was sold in the neighborhood, except at the state liquor agency, where perhaps one might procure a pint if he could convince the agent that he really needed it. Without this proof, the expectant purchaser would be forced to depart empty-handed with none of what I later came to believe was the great panacea for all human ills. Men who had liquor shipped in from Boston or New York by express were looked upon with great distrust and disfavor by most of the good townspeople. The town was well supplied with churches and schools in which I pursued my early educational activities. My father was a professional man of recognized ability, and both my father and mother were most active in church affairs. Dr. Bob's father was a judge. That is Walter Smith, and his mother's Susan Smith. What is interesting, Dr. Bob ultimately became a physician. Dr. Bob's maternal grandfather was also a physician, so he followed in that path. So Susan and Walter Smith are his parents, and the father was a judge. Both father and mother were considerably above the average in intelligence. Unfortunately for me, I was the only child, which perhaps engendered the selfishness which played such an important part in bringing on my alcoholism. So here we are, third paragraph of the story, and he's already highlighted what the true problem is: selfishness, self-centeredness. From childhood through high school, I was more or less forced to go to church, Sunday school, and evening service, Monday night Christian endeavor, and sometimes to Wednesday evening prayer meeting. This had the effect of making me resolve that when I was free from parental domination, I would never again darken the doors of a church. This resolution I kept steadfastly for the next 40 years, except when circumstances made it seem unwise to absent myself. After high school came 4 years in one of the best colleges in the country, where drinking seemed to be a major extracurricular activity. So Dr. Bob ultimately went from high school to the Ivy League school, Dartmouth, which is in Hanover, New Hampshire. For those that don't know, that's right on the New Hampshire-Vermont border. Almost everyone seemed to do it. I did it more and more and had lots of fun without much grief, either physical or financial. I seemed to be able to snap back the next morning better than most of my fellow drinkers who were cursed, or perhaps blessed, with a great deal of morning after nausea. Never once in my life had I had a headache, which fact leads me to believe that I was an alcoholic almost from the start. So Dr. Bob gets there in 1899, and he stays there until 1902. My whole life seemed to be centered around doing what I wanted to do, without regard for the rights, wishes, or privileges of anyone else, a state of mind which became more and more predominant as the years passed. I was graduated summa cum laude in the eyes of the drinking fraternity, but not in the eyes of the dean. The next 3 years I spent in Boston, Chicago, and Montreal in the employ of a large manufacturing concern, selling railway supplies, gas engines of all sorts, and many other items of heavy hardware. During these years, I drank as much as my purse permitted, still without paying too great a penalty, although I was beginning to have morning jitters at times. I lost only a half day's work during these 3 years. My next move was to take up the study of medicine, entering one of the largest universities in the country. And at that time, what he's referring to is Michigan Medical School, Michigan University Medical School. He's there from 1905 to 1907. So he had graduated in 1902. He's referring to the 3 years he did these sales with these heavy hardware, and now comes his first shot at medical school. He's there 1905 to 1907. So what does that tell you? He didn't graduate from there. Okay, so there I took up the business of drinking with much greater earnestness than I had previously shown. On account of my enormous capacity for beer, I was elected to membership in one of the drinking societies and soon became one of the leading spirits. Many mornings I have gone to classes, and even though fully prepared, would turn and walk back to the fraternity house because of my jitters, not daring to enter the classroom for fear of making a scene should I be called on for recitation. This went from bad to worse until sophomore spring when, after a prolonged period of drinking, I made up my mind that I could not complete my course. So I packed my grip and went south to spend a month on a large farm owned by a friend of mine. When I got the fog out of my brain, I decided that quitting school was very foolish and that I had better return and continue my work. When I reached school, I discovered the faculty had other ideas on the subject. After much argument, they allowed me to return and take my exams, all of which I passed credibly. But they were much disgusted and told me they would attempt to struggle along without my presence. After many painful discussions, they finally gave me my credits, and I migrated to another of the leading universities of the country and entered as a junior that fall. So he goes from one med school to another med school. They're referring to Rush Medical in Chicago, and the year is 1907, and he'll stay there until graduation. An elongated graduation. There, my drinking became so much worse that the boys in the fraternity house where I lived felt forced to send for my father, who made a long journey in the vain endeavor to get me straightened around. This had little effect, however, for I kept on drinking and used a great deal more hard liquor than in former years. So we're seeing the progression continue. Coming up to final exams, I went on a particularly strenuous spree. When I went in to write the examinations, my hand trembled so I could not hold a pencil. I passed in at least three absolutely blank books. I was, of course, soon on the carpet, and the upshot was that I had to go back for two more quarters and remain absolutely dry. So what have they basically told? You have to stay for a full extra year and remain dry if I wish to graduate. This I did and proved myself satisfactory to the faculty, both in deportment and scholastically. So he graduates ultimately in 1910. He's there for 3 years. Should have been two. I conducted myself so credibly that I was able to secure a much coveted internship in a western city where I spent 2 years. Take a guess where the western city is. Akron, Ohio. During these 2 years, I was kept so busy that I hardly left the hospital at all. Consequently, I did not get into any trouble. So here he's referring to Akron City Hospital, so that's where he does the internship, and that's ultimately where he stays in the early part of his career. When those 2 years were up, I opened an office downtown Akron. I had some money and all the time in the world and considerable stomach trouble. I soon discovered that a couple of drinks would alleviate my gastric distress, at least for a few hours at a time. So it was not at all difficult for me to return to my former excessive indulgence. By this time, I was beginning to pay very dearly, physically and in the hope of relief, voluntarily incarcerated myself at least a dozen times in one of the local sanitariums. The local sanitarium that he was using at that time was Fair Oaks Villa. I was between Cilia and Charybdis now, because if I did not drink, my stomach tortured me. And if I did, my nerves did the same thing. So this reference is to Greek mythology, and it's two spits of land in which basically you're saying is the choice between two evils. And sailors would, you know, try to navigate down between the two of them and get smashed up against the rocks to one or the other. And this is where we get the more modern phrase of between a rock and a hard place. After 3 years of this, I wound up in the local hospital where they attempted to help me. But I would get my friends to smuggle me a quart, or I would steal the alcohol about the building, so that I got rapidly worse. So the local hospital that he got treatment in obviously wouldn't be Akron City Hospital. I don't know if that would help your career too much. But he would check himself into People's Hospital. People's Hospital. Finally, my father had to send a doctor out from my hometown. Just visualize this. From Vermont to Ohio. Send a doctor out from my hometown who managed to get me back there in some way. And I was in bed about 2 months before I could venture out of the house. I stayed about town a couple of months more and then returned to resume my practice. This is all in 1914. So he graduates in 1910. He's making the reference to progression for those 3 years. Here he is. He's gone, brought back home to his mother and father's house and has to stay there 4 months before he can come back and ultimately pick up his practice. I think I must have been thoroughly scared by what had happened, or by the doctor, or probably both. so that I did not touch a drink again until the country went dry. So what they're talking about there is, of course, prohibition. Prohibition is 1920 to 1933. So let's do the math. He goes home in 1914. He stays there 4 months, and it scares him enough that he doesn't touch a drink for 6 years. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Lots of people can stop. The trick is to stay stopped. Watch what happens. With the passing of the 18th Amendment, Prohibition, I felt quite safe. I knew everyone would buy a few bottles or cases of liquor as their exchequers, their bank account, as their exchequers permitted, and that it would soon be gone. So here he is, he's dry. He's saying, I don't have to worry now. Now you've passed this law, no problem. I'm not going to have any issues with this. People are just going to drink what's left, and then the whole country is going to be without booze. Therefore, it would make no great difference, even if I should do some drinking. At that time, I was not aware that the almost unlimited supply the government made it possible for us doctors to obtain. Neither had I any knowledge of the bootlegger who soon appeared on the horizon. I drank with moderation at first, but it took me only a relatively short time to drift back into the old habits, which had wound up so disastrously before. So what's the choices if you're an alcoholic and you drink? Jails, institutions, or death. There's no fourth choice. So he's gone back to drinking now, right? During the next few years, I developed two distinct phobias. One was the fear of not sleeping, and the other was the fear of running out of liquor. So here's an expression of one part of our illness, the mental obsession. This is the mental he's already kicked this back up for him. Not being a man of means, I knew that if I did not stay sober enough to earn money, I would run out of liquor. Most of the time, therefore, I did not take the morning drink, which I craved so badly, but instead would fill up on large doses of sedatives to quiet the jitters, which distressed me terribly. So he's using the word craved here, but he's not using the word craved in the same way that Dr. Silkworth has. He's really talking about it in terms of a combination of mental obsession and physically wanting it. He's not saying the phenomenon of craving. Occasionally, I would yield to the morning cravings, but if I did, it would be only a few hours before I would be quite unfit for work. This would lessen my chances of smuggling some home that evening, which in turn would mean a night of futile tossing around in bed, followed by a morning of unbearable jitters. So what's read in between the lines there is he's gotten married since then. He hasn't told us that yet. It'll come up in a second. But if you have to smuggle it home, it means that there's somebody there that's watching what you're bringing home. So that it's right there, right? So he's married Anne Ripley, maiden name Ripley. So he's married at this point. During the subsequent 15 years, I had sense enough never to go to the hospital if I had been drinking. And very seldom did I receive patients. I would sometimes hide out in one of the clubs of which I was a member and had the habit at times of registering at a hotel under a fictitious name. But my friends usually found me, and I would go home if they promised that I should not be scolded. So here's the reference now. If my wife was planning to go out in the afternoon, I would get a large supply of liquor and smuggle it home and hide it in the coal bin, the closed chute, over door jams, over beams in the cellar, and in cracks in the cellar tile. I also made use of old trunks and chests, the old can container, and even the ash container. The water tank on the toilet I never used because that looked too easy. I found out later that my wife inspected it frequently. I used to put 8 or 12-ounce bottles of alcohol in a fur-lined glove and toss it onto the back airing porch when winter days got dark enough. My bootlegger had hidden alcohol at the back steps where I could get it at my convenience. So we referenced Ann Smith at this point. They got married in 1915. Sometimes I would bring it in my pockets, but they were inspected and that became too risky. I used also to put it in 4-ounce bottles and stick several in my stocking tops. This worked nicely until my wife and I went to see Wallace Beery in Tugboat Annie, after which the pant leg and stocking racket wore out. I will not take space to relate all my hospital or sanitarium experiences. He's already told us about 12. During all of this time, we became more or less ostracized by our friends. We could not be invited out because I would surely get tight, and my wife dared not invite people in for the same reason. My phobia for sleeplessness demanded that I get drunk every night. But in order to get more liquor for the next night, I had to stay sober during the day, at least up to 4 o'clock. This routine went on with few interruptions for 17 years. I was really a horrible nightmare. Excuse me. It was really a horrible nightmare. This earning money, getting liquor, smuggling it home, getting drunk, morning jitters, taking large doses of sedatives to make it possible for me to earn more money and go and so on ad nauseum. I used to promise my wife, my friends, and my children that I would drink no more, promises which seldom kept me sober even through the day, though I was very sincere when I made them. For the benefit of those experimentally inclined, I should mention the so-called beer experiment. When beer first came back, I thought that I was safe. I could drink all I wanted of that. It was harmless. No one ever got drunk on beer. So I filled the cellar full with the permission of my good wife. It was not long before I was drinking at least a case and a half a day. I put on 30 pounds of weight in about 2 months, looked like a pig, and was uncomfortable from shortness of breath. It then occurred to me that after one was all smelled up with beer, nobody could tell what had been drunk. So I began to fortify my beer with straight alcohol. Of course, the result was very bad, and that ended the beer experiment. About the time of the beer experiment, I was thrown in with a crowd of people who attracted me because of their seeming poise, health, and happiness. So we're now at 1933. Prohibition went from 20 to 33. He talks about beer comes back. It's now legal. He's thrown in with this crowd of people. Who's the crowd of people? The Oxford group. So this is the first exposure he gets to the Oxford group. They spoke with great freedom from embarrassment, which I could never do. And they seemed very much at ease on all occasions and appeared very healthy. More than these attributes, they seemed to be happy. I was self-conscious and ill at ease most of the time. My health was at the breaking point, and I was thoroughly miserable. I sensed they had something I did not have from which I might readily profit. I learned that it was something of a spiritual nature, which did not appeal to me very much, but I thought it could do no harm. I gave the matter much time and study for the next 2.5 years, but I still got tight every night nevertheless. So he studies all up on the Oxford group. He attends their Wednesday night meeting at T. Henry and Clarice Williams' home. Ann Smith does, Henrietta Seiberling does, a lot of the great residents of Akron participate in this movement, and so he's dealing with them from 33 to 35. But he can't get sober. Number one ingredient why he can't get sober is he never admits he has a problem with alcohol. Step one: never admits it. And he studies all he can about it, and it doesn't get him sober. So self-knowledge doesn't do it. My wife became deeply interested, and it was her interest that sustained mine. though I at no time sensed that it might be an answer to my liquor problem, how my wife kept her faith and courage during all those years, I'll never know, but she did. If she had not, I know I would have been dead a long time ago. For some reason, we alcoholics seem to have the gift of picking out the world's finest women. Why they should be subjected to the tortures we inflict upon them, I cannot explain. About this time, a lady called up my wife one Saturday afternoon saying she wanted me to come over that evening to meet a friend of hers who might help me. So they're referring to Henrietta Cyberling, and she's calling from the gatehouse on the Cyberling estate. Those of you who have visited the Cyberling estate, it is, I think you could genuinely call it a mansion. The gatehouse is not. It's a humble house on the property. But so what we're seeing here is that Dr. Bob's involved with the Oxford Group for 2.5 years. Right at this point, he admits to the group, it takes him 2.5 years, he admits to the group that he's a problem with booze. And that puts him in the position to be right with the cosmos, in that the cosmos, the higher power, the God, the deity, the divine, puts exactly the right person into his life to help him with his problem. But ultimately, and that's Bill Wilson, but ultimately Bill Wilson is calling him to help Bill Wilson. Right? We're going to hear that story about the Mayflower Hotel in a minute, or thing it comes up here, but we'll deal with it, in which it's the idea of not going out and saving people. The idea is to do good work with no expectation of return, good 12-step work, help another with no expectation of return, and the spiritual paradox is that's how you get and stay sober. So you give with freely, and you get without expectation. Okay, it was the day before Mother's Day, and I had come home plastered, carrying a big potted plant, which I set down on the table and forthwith went upstairs and passed out. The next day, she called again. So Ann picked up the phone the first day and said, nah, he's drunk, can't do it. So Henrietta calls the next day, and this is Dr. Bob making the statement, wishing to be polite. Though I fell very badly, I said, let's make the call, and extracted from my wife a promise that we would not stay over 15 minutes. We entered her house at exactly 5 o'clock, and it was 11:15 when we left, so 6 hours, 15 minutes. I had a couple of shorter talks with this man afterward and stopped drinking abruptly, struck sober based on this initial interaction. Actually, Dr. Bob doesn't use the word sober. We'll see in the next sentence. This dry spell lasted for about 3 weeks. Then I went to Atlantic City to attend several days meeting of a national society of which I was a member. He's referring to the American Medical Association and down in Atlantic City once a year. And he had gone for 20 years straight. And he was 3 weeks sober. He figured, hey, I mastered this thing. I can handle this. What are you talking about? I'm going. And Ann was hesitant. Bill said, no, you can't, let him go. You don't shield these guys. You either struck sober or you're not. So let's just, better we find out now anyway. So he takes the train down from Akron to Atlantic City, and, he's drunk in like 4 minutes. I drank all the scotch they had on the train and bought several quarts on my way to the hotel. This was on Sunday. I got tight that night, stayed sober Monday till after the dinner, and then proceeded to get tight again. I drank all I dared in the bar and then went to my room to finish the job. Tuesday, I started in the morning, getting well organized by noon. I did not want to disgrace myself, so I then checked out. I bought some more liquor on the way to the depot. I had to wait some time for the train. I remember nothing from then on until I woke up at a friend's house in a town near home. So his friend is his receptionist, who he calls when he gets to the station. And the receptionist's name is Lily, and her husband's name is Everett. They come, they get him, and they bring him to their own home. These good people notified my wife, who sent my newly made friend, Bill Wilson, over to get me. He came and got me home and to bed, gave me a few drinks that night and one bottle of beer the next morning. That was June 10th, 1935, and that was my last drink. As I write, nearly 4 years have passed. So he's writing this in 39, he got sober in 35. The reference that they're making on that first line there, the story in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers is that Bill and Bob are sharing a bedroom, twin beds, and Dr. Bob, in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, turns over and says to Bill, "I'm going to go through with this." And Bill says, "Oh, you mean the surgery you have to do tomorrow morning?" He said, no, I'm going to do that. No, I'm going to go through with this sober thing, this spiritual experience to conquer alcoholism. I'm going to go through with this." And Bill says, "Okay, that's great. Bill gets up, and it's making the reference here. Dr. Bob has to go to the hospital and repair a former surgery to tweak it to get it correct. And before he walks into the hospital, he hands him a beer and he hands him a goofball, a down, a sedative. And that is June 10th, 1935. So Dr. Bob goes inside, does the surgery. Bill goes home. Bill and Ann are waiting for Dr. Bob to come home. And I think it makes reference someplace in here. But what happens is Dr. Bob doesn't come home. It's like midnight. And they're like, "Oh, boy, he's drinking." And no, he was so moved by this whole thing that he actually was already making ninth step amends. So in his first day, this guy was cruising. The question which might naturally come into your mind would be, what did the man do or say that was different from what others had done or said? It must be remembered that I had read a great deal and talked to everyone who knew or thought they knew anything about the subject of alcoholism. But this was a man who had experienced many years of frightful drinking. And that's what we have different than the religious community and the medical community. That's the closing argument. That's the one ingredient that you can't get out of a book. It's your own personal experience. Who had most all the drunkard's experiences known to man, but who had been cured by the very means I had been trying to employ. That is to say, the spiritual approach. So again, we don't use the term cured now. We make a distinction between it. Here, they weren't up to that point yet of that sort of fine definition. He gave me information about the subject of alcoholism, which was undoubtedly helpful, italicized, very important, of far more importance than what? Knowledge. Knowledge is not that important in this gig. Of far more importance was the fact that he was the first living human with whom I had ever talked, who knew what he was talking about in regard to alcoholism from actual experience. In other words, he talked my language. That was the difference. And it's all the difference in the world. He knew all the answers, and certainly not because he had picked them up in his reading. It is a most wonderful blessing to be relieved of the terrible curse with which I was afflicted. My health is good, and I have regained my self-respect and the respect of my colleagues. My home life is ideal, and my business is as good as can be expected in these uncertain times. I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learned to others who want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. One, a sense of duty. Two, it is a pleasure. Three, because in doing so, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. Four, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. Unlike most of our crowd, I did not get over my craving for liquor much during the first 2.5 years of abstinence. It was almost always with me, but at no time have I been anywhere near yielding. I used to get terribly upset when I saw my friends drink and knew I could not. But I schooled myself to believe that though I once had the same privilege, I had abused it so frightfully that it was withdrawn. So it doesn't behoove me to squawk about it, for, after all, no one ever had to throw me down and pour liquor down my throat. If you think you are an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which keeps you from accepting what is in this book, I feel sorry for you. If you still think you are strong enough to beat the game alone, that is your affair. But if you really and truly want to quit drinking liquor for good and all, and sincerely feel that you must have some help, we know that we have an answer for you. It never fails. If you go about it with 1/2 the zeal you have been in the habit of showing when you were getting another drink, your heavenly Father will never let you down. And we're going to stop there tonight.